News, I'm Brian Clark. Air Force Central Command used three C-130 cargo planes to drop more than 60 pallets of humanitarian aid over Gaza. U.S. officials say that included 38,000 meals as part of the plan that President Biden announced Friday.
Innocent lives are on the line and children's lives are on the line. I mean, we won't stand by and let until we get more aid in there. We should be getting hundreds of trucks in, not just several.
He made the announcement a day after more than 100 people were killed trying to get humanitarian aid. Walgreens and CVS announced they will start selling the abortion pill mifepristone in areas where it is legal. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the wildfire burning in the panhandle, the largest in the state's history, may have destroyed 500 buildings. There are also concerns the fire could grow because there are strong winds in today's forecast. This is ABC News. Regulators in California authorized Waymo to expand its fleet of robo-taxis into Los Angeles and into cities on the peninsula south of San Francisco, where they've already been operating. Waymo's been in Phoenix since 2020. A first in Los Angeles.
I, Dominic Choi.
For the first time, Los Angeles has an Asian American police chief. Dominic Choi, the LAPD's new interim leader, sworn in, taking over for retiring Chief Michael Moore, who led the department through the pandemic. Chief Choi's father pinned his badge on him, Choi saying,
"Let us recognize that our differences are our strength."
Choi will likely be chief of the LAPD for a few months until a permanent chief is chosen. Alex Stone, ABC News, Los Angeles.
Governor of Missouri commuted the prison sentence for Britt Reed, the son of Chiefs head coach Andy Reed, who had been sentenced to 3 years in a DWI case. Reed was a Chiefs assistant coach at the time. He'll serve on house arrest until 2025. Brian Clark, ABC News.
You need skill and a little luck to play the game of pool, and you could say one Q-making company in Wisconsin has both. Schmelke Q's in Rice Lake is the oldest pool Q-maker in the U.S. and remains a family-owned, third-generation operated business. Schmelke started as a one-man shop in the 1940s. Now more than 20 employees work at the facility. So do you know which state has the most Q-making manufacturers? Is it Maryland, Minnesota, Wisconsin? The answer coming up. Pool is an old game, and the cues similar to the ones used to play today were created in the late 1600s in Northern Europe. Pool came to America in the 19th century. So did you guess which state currently has four of the top five cue manufacturers? It is Wisconsin. And Schmelke Cues in Rice Lake has also been inducted into the International Cue Makers Hall of Fame, making this a worldwide slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Tune in Monday for a very special Devil's Advocates radio show. We got Chuck Quala coming in studio 4 to 6 p.m. across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 50s, a little breezy out of the south. Breezy tonight, 42, and breezy again for your Sunday. Those south winds pushing our high temperatures into the mid-60s with mostly sunny skies. Chance of rain in 42 on Sunday night.
Right now, 40 degrees.
From the home of the largest fly-in in the world, we are Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Welcome back to this, our second hour of our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me and my wonderful producer, Sam. We're coming to you this morning from the terrific studios of Civic Media in downtown Madison, just adjacent to the campus of UW-Madison, right here, not too far from our state capital. And we are, as always, soliciting your comments and questions, your inquiries. We're going to get to those in just a few moments or so. This, of course, our weekly review, our analysis, our survey of the major events and stories in our lives having to do with government and law and the aspiration for justice in America. Speaking a lot this morning, as we often do, about the United States Supreme Court determining pretty much what's going to happen with respect to social media cases, probably finding that attempts by state legislatures to restrict the capacity of private platform providers to remove platform information from their platforms, that those laws are probably going to be stricken down by the Supreme Court. And then we have this other case we were talking about right before the top of the hour having to do with bump stocks and whether or not bump stocks that basically convert certain kinds of weapons into machine guns, which are indeed illegal in America, whether bump stock can and should be regulated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. This case brought by a fellow named Michael Cargill, who is a seller of bump stocks in his home state of Texas. Lots of divergent opinions coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week in that oral argument. Sonia Sotomayor, for example, says, why would even a person with arthritis, why would Congress think that they need to shoot 400 to 700 or 800 rounds of ammunition under any circumstances? This is a part of a colloquy with the attorneys appearing before her. But some of the more conservative justices, including Sam Alito and Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, raised some concerns about the effect of the ban on people who had bought bump stocks previously before these accessories were prohibited. What happens to all of them? Asking questions about when the federal ban would apply to them. Justice Alito asking what would happen to people who have owned bump stocks in the years since the ban, including those living in the part of the country where a federal appeals court overturned the ban. Can they be prosecuted, he asks. And when the government said yes, Alito quickly responded, isn't that disturbing? Justice Kavanaugh said that's going to ensnare a lot of people who are not aware of legal prohibitions, and the argument goes on. As I said before, a lot of disagreement, not clarity from the Supreme Court of exactly where this is going. The Chief Justice himself raising some concerns about why the Congress, along with Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch, is not acting to make this clear. Why should the courts be the one to decide this? But along the way, you've got Ketanji Brown Jackson and Alito engaging and extended back and forth with the lawyers, pressing them on how to interpret this particular ATF statute. Alito appeared supportive of an argument that the ban overreached because that device does not physically touch and move the trigger mechanism in a rifle, getting very technical when in terms of actually what a bump stock does and what it does not do. Justice Jackson seemed very skeptical of that argument, appeared more supportive of the government's position in this. The device should be banned. Why? Because of its practical effect on a gun, sharply increasing the speed and the number of bullets it can fire. Justice Kagan appears to agree. She says, I mean, maybe you could use the device differently, but the entire point of this device is that you exert forward pressure and you have your finger on the trigger, and then a torrent of bullets shoots out. So we plainly have some disagreement among members of our Supreme Court. Unclear exactly how they will come down on this issue of bump stocks in America. But again, a case coming up for decision almost certainly, along with other firearms-related cases coming up for decision in June, in the midst of our continuing challenges, which we have every week, every day in America with respect to firearms. The loss is dramatic, catastrophic in many ways, not just mass shootings of the sort that we saw way back in 2017 in Las Vegas, but virtually every single day, every single week in America, we know that there have been more mass shootings in America this year than there have been days in the calendar. Attempts by legislatures to apply those things that we know work, including a bans on assault weapons. We had that in America for about 10 years. That legislation sunset after a while. And other things that we know work, background checks and other safety mechanisms for in-the-home storage and use of weapons. All those kinds of things we know work because in those states where they have, in fact, been passed, they bring down the rates of firearm-related injuries and deaths. We know as well that the number one abuse of firearms is by suicide. And there, too, things involving lethal violent protective orders, those states where those have been impacted dramatically, the incidence of suicides in cases in their jurisdictions, we've seen the effect of those good kinds of laws that do not roll back Second Amendment rights, as the Supreme Court has said, but acknowledge, as those same cases have said, that under the law, reasonable restrictions on the manufacture and the use, the distribution, the movement, the sale of firearms can indeed be regulated, depending upon the circumstances, the people who are involved. All of those reasonable regulations, those kinds of things, those conditions on the right established under the Second Amendment. Justice Antonin Scalia told us that many, many years ago, that the right under the Second Amendment is not inviolate. It's not. It's not unconditional. And indeed, the question here is whether or not bump stocks fall on one side of that line or another. The Supreme Court will tell us, hopefully giving us some reason to believe that the decision in Bruin and arguably even in Heller has some limited application and is in fact a part of the Supreme Court's focus on keeping us safe and secure. That is not their principal focus, of course. That's what law enforcement does. But they do have this all-important role when it comes to interpreting the law and ensuring that the law is effected, is put in place, and is effectuated by those people who've got responsibility for its execution in a way that keeps us safe and secure. Bump stocks in America on our national docket just this past week, along with all these other cases before our United States Supreme Court. We have got a caller on the line. Again, we appreciate very much our callers today, soliciting, encouraging your calls at 608-610-1126. Sam and I taking your phone calls here in the studios of Civic Media in downtown Madison. Mark, glad to have you with us this morning for your comment or your question.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call, Jim. Yeah, it seems to me that the Supreme Court adopting this, taking up the case on Trump's immunity claim, is another, at least for some of the members of the Supreme Court, a furtherance of the insurrection. That because, you know, Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, you know, Clarence Thomas via his wife, and Sam Alito apparently was involved in the taking away the Electoral College count and turning it over to the states. Part of that conspiracy, a conspiracy. This is a nationwide conspiracy that they're taking this on to delay the court making, you know, the court, you know, Donald Trump being convicted of his part in the insurrection is just kind of disgusting. I mean, that the voting public has the right to know that what Donald Trump's involvement was in this. I think then what needs to happen, because we're not going to see it coming before the courts, every scrap of information that's publicly available should be put out there so we can, the public themselves can evaluate that information.
An awful lot of information. Mark, I think your point is very well taken. An awful lot of polling, if you will, to suggest that people do want to know about this. And it's going to affect their vote as well. The practical impact, as you've implicitly, if not explicitly, stated, and we're commenting about this in our first hour, that the decision by the Supreme Court to grant certiorari to put this on this schedule, an April oral argument, a decision in June, almost makes it impossible for this case to be tried to a jury verdict, which I think an awful lot of people would like to know about before casting their vote. Primaries will be long gone, but certainly the general election in November, that's the issue. And those people are very skeptical about the Supreme Court, say that even though they will, hopefully, should need to come out with this opinion that says, no, presidents are not immune from prosecution. The practical effect of this with respect to their decision to postpone its ultimate resolution when they had an alternative, which is basically to say, yes, the Court of Appeals is right. The lower court was right. Get this trial back on track, which has been suspended for months now. That decision effectively may, if Donald Trump is reelected president, may bring this prosecution to an end. An awful lot of speculation. He has virtually said it himself that if he becomes the next president, through his Justice Department, these cases, these federal cases, will be dismissed. And the state cases may remain around. But even those, there's a non-frivolous argument that a state cannot imprison, maybe can convict, maybe can try a sitting president, but a question about whether or not even a state, while a sitting president is in the White House, whether a state can proceed with those cases or has to wait until after the term is done, an awful lot depends upon what happens in November. And Mark, to your good point about the population knowing, regardless of what your partisan inclinations are, the population looking at this case, perhaps among the most important among all those cases, and saying, if there's a jury that reviews the evidence here presented by the government and finds as a matter of fact and law, finds beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimously, that Donald Trump engaged in these crimes, the interference, the insurrection as charged, that is compelling information. And Mark, that's your point, right? To ensure that the Americans do, in fact, have the possibility of knowing about that information so that it can animate their vote and determine whether or not to vote for Donald Trump in the fall election. It is significant, of course, that all of these indictments come out of grand juries, at least the federal cases do, and Georgia does as well. All of those come out of a process where individuals have already taken a look at the evidence, maybe not even all of the evidence, and found probable cause to believe that the crimes have been committed. It's not a proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a higher standard at the trial court level. But again, we've got federal grand juries. This is not Merrick Garland. This is not Jack Smith coming to the conclusion and simply releasing these charges. It certainly is not the White House. It's not Joe Biden saying, yes, charge Donald Trump. It is a grand jury that in all these cases, both in the Mar-a-Lago case, in the interference case, they've looked at the evidence, the testimony, the documents, and they have said there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed, crimes have been committed, and that's the case that needs to go to trial. Unlikely, once again, that will happen. We do know, of course, the case that likely will go to trial. We know that in late March, this month, March 25th, Alvin Bragg, the DA in Manhattan, probably will go ahead and try that so-called catch and kill case involving allegations of violations of New York state law, that before Judge Juan Merchan. That case probably going to trial late this month. That may be the only one. When we come back, we're going to talk more about another Supreme Court matter pending right now before our high court, and then move on to other matters also in the area of the rule of law. Stay with us for that important discussion.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Hey, it's the fabulous Farm Bay Pam Yonke with the Midwest Farm Report, heard weekday mornings at 5 right here on WISS. If you like food, if you like farmers, tune in and learn. 5 a.m. on Air Support 93.3 FM and 1100 a.m. Oshkosh.
Matt Nair on air.
Hovde, Eric Hovde now. He will be running against Tammy Baldwin.
He's not a Wisconsinite. He threw his hat in the ring from California. This is Tim Michaels all over again. Businessman who walks in and goes, well, I can take care of this. And Wisconsin says, no. Good to know you. Here's some Kringle. Go back home.
Is that how we politely blow people off now, is to take a Kringle and go away?
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
This is Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
We are back talking about all things legal, all things rule of law, all things administration of justice, and the aspiration for it here in our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for joining me for this, our second hour on Saturday, March 2nd, 2024. My excellent producer, Sam, and I are in the studios of Civic Media here in Madison, Wisconsin today. Our phone line is 608-610-1126, 608-610-1126. Always enjoy your entertaining phone calls that do, in fact, prompt inspiration and insight with respect to the things that we're discussing on a regular basis. So bring those calls on and be a part of our discussion this morning, as always, as a part of that engagement on these important issues. A significant event with respect to commerce in America this past week, and two of our major pharmacies, CVS and Walgreens. CVS and Walgreens in the news just this past week, the two largest pharmacy chains in the United States of America announcing that they're going to start dispensing the abortion pill mifepristone this month. And that step obviously could make that drug much easier for some patients. Officials at both of those companies, CVS and Walgreens, said just yesterday they had received certification to dispense mifepristone under guidelines that the Food and Drug Administration issued just last year. Now, this is, again, one of those matters that involves agency determinations. We've talked a lot about this. We made reference to it early in this morning's broadcast as well. You recall well that a federal district court judge in Texas determined that the decision by the Food and Drug Administration to authorize the use of mifepristone, among other drugs, in connection with providing reproductive services and abortion services in particular, that is lawful on the basis that it is also safe and secure. And the federal district court judge looked at 25 years of studies and examinations, the FDA, one of those agencies, appliance expertise, its insight into this, making the determination that, yes, this drug is useful and it's also safe for this particular kind of medical service, the federal district court judge substituting his opinion for that of the FDA and finding, again, in this area of doubting what an agency can and should be doing out there, said, I'm going to rely upon some studies, some fringe studies that have since been withdrawn, since been shown to be invalid and not supporting of the notion that the FDA did anything other than properly reviewed the use of mifepristone. He relies upon these fringe documents to say that mifepristone cannot be distributed any further by the FDA and poses that as an injunctive, a prohibitive order entered by the federal district court judge. So what happens, of course, this goes up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Fifth Circuit there has oral argument, also very skeptical about the FDA. Again, a part of this general skepticism of agencies out there. We've talked about it recently in the context of the likely rescission of the Chevron doctrine, this doctrine that says that when there are determinations to be made by federal judges, if the statutes passed by Congress are not especially clear, if they're ambiguous, if there's a gap in them some way, that there is deference to the agencies. There's deference to their expertise, their understanding, their lives of working on these kinds of issues when it comes to interpreting the law and applying it, again, to the good of America. The Fifth Circuit, looking at the decision by the lower judge, it basically dropkicked the Chevron concept and said, no, I'm substituting my view, my gut, for what the agency has determined over the period of about a quarter century or so. Fifth Circuit takes that up and says, we're not going to go quite that far. We're not going to ban mifepristone. But they did say they were going to ban the mailing of mifepristone and required in-person doctor visits. And again, obviously addressing the issue of access to the drug itself. And if the Supreme Court, where this case is now pending, If the Supreme Court upholds that ruling, it could mean that patients would have to obtain mifepristone by visiting a clinic, a doctor, or a pharmacy, again, according to what the Fifth Circuit has said. Now, why is this important? Well, it's a confluence, once again, of things going on in the commercial world here. That is CVS and Walgreens announcing just this past week they're going to begin selling the abortion pill this coming month. They have gotten the authorization to do it. Pharmacy certification granted by the manufacturers of mifepristone. Walgreens says it was certified by the brand name manufacturer Danko Laboratories. It's also seeking, apparently, some certification from the generic manufacturer called GenBioPro. CVS was already certified by GenBioPro, and so they're going to go ahead and do this even while the Supreme Court is determining whether or not the Fifth Circuit decision that limits access to it is constitutional. All this, obviously, in the wake of the return, the reversal, the overtaking of Roe versus Wade by the Dobbs decision, all of that coming in the wake of this, and also again, an illustration of this issue of federal judges, independent of the expertise of agencies and the good things that they bring to it, not perfect, certainly subject to review, certainly subject to a reasonable risk review by the federal judges, whether or not a lower court judge and now an appeals court judge should substitute its views and the views of the judges on those panels for the decisions made by the experts out there. The Supreme Court has indicated, since we're taking account of all of our calendars in March and in April, that on March 26th, yes, indeed, that's one day if you're marking your calendars, after the hush money case begins in Manhattan, presumably that issue unrelated to mifepristone, but one day, March 25th, is the start of the Manhattan trial, the catch and kill trial, Marvin Bragg that we talked about just a few moments ago. The following day, the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., entertaining oral argument on this Fifth Circuit case on the future of mifepristone and whether or not the lower courts are right in limiting access to it, maybe even limiting its permissible use generally around the country, and determining whether or not the FDA's determination that it is a safe and secure drug should be supported or not. That happening, the oral argument on March 26th. Again, yet another case coming up for decision in June. June is going to be a busy month. We'll be right here, of course, on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking with you about all of these kinds of cases in many, many areas, once again underscoring the impact that our Supreme Court has, especially in areas where the Supreme Court said, at least in the guns case, Congress is not acting. There are not a lot of legislative enactments when it comes to guns, other things. They could enter into this as well, make legislative determinations. And indeed, there's a fairly compelling argument that the people send to our federal and state legislatures representatives to do what? To pass laws, to make these decisions, to wrestle with the opinions of experts, and to determine whether or not legislation should be passed that goes one way or another. What we are seeing more and more, and the mifepristone case suggests that, as do other cases, that because legislatures are not acting in these areas, are not acting in the area of guns, for example, what we have now more and more, the federal and some state courts also entering that vacuum, if you will, and making decisions that probably should be best decided by our legislatures, because those are the folks we send to Congress, to our state house, to make those all important determinations about what the law should say in America. Lots coming up in that area as well in June for case decision by the United States Supreme Court. We're going to talk more about all of that, of course, in the days ahead, including the impact of the Supreme Court decisions, as our caller Mark said, this immunity decision on other cases pending involving Donald Trump, and frankly, the future of our nation as well. All of that a part of our future discussions right here in our Saturday morning broadcast. Stay with us for more of this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast, Saturday, March 2nd, 2024.
Moving me down the highway, rolling me down the highway. Pass me by.
Broadcasting from the Civic Media Studios on South Main Street, this is Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM, WISS.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Air Force Central Command used three C-130 cargo planes to drop more than 60 pallets of humanitarian aid over Gaza. U.S. officials say that included 38,000 meals as part of the plan that President Biden announced Friday.
Innocent lives are on the line and children's lives are on the line. I mean, we won't stand by and let until we get more aid in there. We should be getting hundreds of trucks in, not just several.
He made the announcement a day after more than 100 people were killed trying to get humanitarian aid. Walgreens and CVS announced they will start selling the abortion pill mifepristone in areas where it is legal. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says the wildfire burning in the panhandle, the largest in the state's history, may have destroyed 500 buildings. There are also concerns the fire could grow because there are strong winds in today's forecast. This is ABC News.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
Bucks win again.
Hi,
I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks beat the Bulls in Chicago 113-97. Giannis with 46 points and 16 rebounds. The Bucks have now won five in a row. Chicago's Nikola Vukovic got frustrated and smacked Milwaukee's AJ Green in the face and was ejected from the game. Head coach Doc Rivers.
It was great. You know what? I just liked our defensive energy all game. I thought that's what changed the game. Thought we got into them. Game got a little chippy, but I thought it got chippy over just defensive pressure. Just as long as we keep our composure, that was the only thing I kept telling our guys. So, and then Giannis, you know, it's that thing we talked about, feeding the pig, meaning if you fall on a plate, it works. And we had the little angle action, stay with it. You know, the one time they went away from, that's when I jumped up and said, why would you go away from something that just keep running it and keep running and something else, then you do that.
That's the Bucks head coach, Doc Rivers. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 50s, a little breezy out of the south. Breezy tonight, 42, and breezy again for your Sunday. Those south winds pushing our high temperatures into the mid-60s with mostly sunny skies. Chance of rain in 42 on Sunday night.
Right now, 40 degrees.
An RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Matt Nair on air.
Hovde, Eric Hovde now. He will be running against Tammy Baldwin.
He's not a Wisconsinite. He threw his hat in the ring from California. This is Tim Michaels all over again. Businessman who walks in and goes, well, I can take care of this. And Wisconsin says, no. Good to know you. Here's some Kringle. Go back home.
Is that how we politely blow people off now? Is to take a Kringle and go away.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Todd Almost Show.
Green Bay's a fine town, but I'm just telling you, you're better off to take a horse. Don't drive in Green Bay, and for God's sake, don't get a parking ticket. So how about this? We find out how much revenue does Green Bay get from parking tickets, and we say that the Packers are going to donate that, and we're going to have free parking in Green Bay. How about that? Todd for mayor of Green Bay.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Your home for Mino and the Mayor in the Morning. Weekdays from 6 till 8. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM WISS.
Hit the road, Jack. You're a are back talking this morning about all sorts of rule of law issues in our Saturday morning broadcast. Let's take a couple more of those up right now. We talked before about the criminal cases pending in Manhattan, also in the District of Columbia with respect to presidential candidate Donald Trump. Let's go south and talk a little bit about something that happened yesterday in Florida. Judge Eileen Cannon presiding over this Mar-a-Lago documents case. You know it well. That Donald Trump and some co-defendants charged with improperly taking and possessing and using documents, some classified, some not, that he should not have taken, should not have used. You know all about those federal charges there pending in Florida, federal case before Judge Eileen Cannon. Now, the question again is timing on all this. The case has been indicted for a while, also being prosecuted by Jack Smith, who again is the special counsel from the Department of Justice handling this case as well, in addition to the federal insurrection, the interference case going ahead, or right now not going ahead in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan in the District of Columbia. But Eileen Cannon has an active case, and she is entertaining pretrial matters of various sorts. We'll get to that in just a moment or so. She had what's called a pretrial hearing just yesterday in front of the parties to the case. That includes, of course, the government and representatives of the defendants, including Donald Trump. An awful lot of anticipation that Eileen Cannon was now going to tell us as we all continue to pull out our calendars for this coming year, both political calendars and litigation calendars, criminal prosecution, civil prosecution. And the anticipation was that Eileen Cannon would be giving a trial date for that Mar-a-Lago documents case. Again, it returned by a federal grand jury. A federal grand jury returning this case from its review of the materials presented to it. The parties proposing two different proposals to her before and during the hearing yesterday. The government, Jack Smith, saying, let's start on July 8th. Let's do this right after Independence Day here in America. We'll be prepared to go. And indeed, Jack Smith, as he has been saying to all of the judges who will listen, the justices who will listen in Washington, D.C., he is prepared to go on the case there, the insurrection, the interference case as well. He's saying the same thing to Eileen Cannon. Obviously, his staff prosecutes these cases under his supervision and direction, although he himself mightily involved, hands involved in the prosecution of these cases. He says, let's go on July 8th. And the judge gives an awful lot of indication that's way too soon. On the other hand, much to a surprise of many people, Donald Trump's attorneys say, well, July 8th is too early, but August 12th. August 12th is the date that we would like to proceed to trial on this. You might say, well, gee, that's very interesting, given a practice, if you will, by his attorneys to seek postponements. They've articulated in this case and in other cases previously the notion that these cases should not be tried until after the election for obvious reasons that we've talked about both politically and legally. And so it was something of a surprise when his attorneys said, no, let's go to trial on August 12th. And the suggestion, of course, is that what he was truly, really trying to do was trying to, if you will, identify a block of time there in Florida when the case would be tried, if at all, that would also preclude the contemporaneous trial of the interference case in Washington, D.C. Let's suppose Supreme Court in June says, yes, you can go ahead with that interference case, Tanya Chutkan, and she decides that she wants to schedule this fairly quickly in July or August. The suggestion was, the strategy presumably is, that Donald Trump asking Eileen Cannon to set the Mar-a-Lago documents case for August would then preclude Tanya Chutkan from doing her trial in Washington, D.C. in the same time, certainly postponing that one further beyond the election, if not well into 2025 and perhaps even beyond that. So it's a strategy that is interesting and notable given what the parties are proposing for the trial dates. In the end, Judge Eileen Cannon, I will say, disappointed us all with a small d because she didn't decide on any of that. She said it's unlikely it's going to go ahead very soon. She did not give us a specific trial date. She's previously scheduled this for May. Plainly, that is not going to happen. And more, as these cases, again, continue to be postponed in terms of not only settling cases for a docket, for a trial, a calendar, but also for substantive review. Lots and lots of things have got to happen before cases go to trial. And we've chatted about this a lot. Pre-trial motions to dismiss, the motion in Washington, D.C., challenging the very legitimacy of the case under this immunity theory. It's a frivolous theory. That's a pre-trial motion. There can be other motions, presumably in the Mar-a-Lago case, having to do, for example, with the search, the legitimacy of the search. You can challenge that. The legitimacy of the very charges themselves, all kinds of things, motions to suppress evidence, motions to limit the capacity of the government to do various things, all those kinds of pretrial matters resolved by a trial court before the trial can happen. That's why, once again, even if these cases were set for specific dates, lots and lots of things have got to happen before a jury is impaneled to actually hear the case and decide whether the case is proven by the government beyond a reasonable doubt. So one of those things that Eileen Cannon, in addition to this trial date, which she has not resolved, what else does she have in front of her? Well, we know well that one of those matters is determining whether or not she's going to allow Donald Trump's lawyers to include in one of their public filings the names of about two dozen or so witnesses who might testify at trial. And we've talked about this at great length. Jack Smith and his prosecutors working for him have said that kind of thing, they vehemently protested that move, that kind of thing, that public disclosure would expose those witnesses to the same sorts of threats, the possibility of intimidation that we have seen in other instances in America in recent months and certainly in recent years, judges being threatened, court staff being threatened, witnesses being intimidated. Jack Smith, very, very concerned about the publication, the release publicly of the names, even the locations of those witnesses could not only threaten them, but what is the other concern, the secondary concern? It would impact the very conduct of the trial itself. If witnesses are intimidated, are not inclined to come forward, even upon subpoenas, that has an impact upon the administration of justice and the forward movement of the rule of law. So he has vehemently opposed that kind of matter. That's pending before Judge Eileen Cannon right now. The other decision she's got is this equally highly unusual request by Donald Trump's lawyers to see some secret government filings that detail the very sensitive classified discovery material that prosecutors at Jack Smith say he's got no right to see. And where does that come from? Well, again, this is a documents case. But as I said before, classified documents, other cases, other instances, even where the documents are not classified, matters of national security. And so one of the major things that has to happen before a judge can impanel a jury is to make these decisions pre-trial, prior to the start of proceedings, about how it is we're going to handle in a public proceeding in front of America, documents, information that potentially could compromise the safety and security, the national security of our nation. This issue of sensitive classified discovery that can and is provided to the defense, but is not disclosed to them for public dissemination. How do you handle that? How do you manage that when it comes to actually trying the case in a very public domain? Media plainly has a great interest in identifying what that is. Plainly, the national security infrastructure of our government does not want that information released. And we know as well that that kind of thing happening out there, that release of information can compromise not only our sources overseas, our agents, our people who are preserving our safety and security overseas, but also could potentially call into question even our relationship with those other foreign countries. It becomes clear that national security interests and information shared inside our government, inside our trial courts, is not in fact secret. Our allies overseas and other places around the world may be less inclined to share their information with us. That also sort of the derivative impact upon disclosures of national security information that is not reviewed by and determined by the judge to be handled in a way that's appropriate for it. An awful lot of trials can, in fact, go forward without the formal release of that information into the public domain. It can be done, but it takes a lot of time. And we know here in this Mar-a-Lago case, huge numbers of documents, many, many of them classified. How do you handle that? She's got to respond to all of that and figure that out between now and the time the trial begins. We know as well that the prosecutors, Jack Smith, when it comes to that issue, identified recently as she began to go down a certain road that she had committed a clear error, as she said, as the government said, when she applied her standard to the analysis that she had before her. The prosecutors let her know very, very quickly and very, very stridently that they opposed her inclination in this area and specifically releasing the witnesses' names. And as a result of that, the government pushing back on her initial decisions about the witness issue, she quickly put on hold her position after the government's complaint. So lots and lots of things have got to happen there, significantly coming out of the Florida court, the district court just this past week. No decision on when that trial would go ahead, and lots of things that have to be resolved before a jury can be impaneled. Let's do one other rule of law snapshot here this morning before we go overseas for some additional commentary about the rule of law, and that is something else we've talked about a lot on our Saturday morning broadcast, and that's Jack Teixeira. Jack Teixeira, as you may recall, this Massachusetts Air National Guardsman, was accused of posting dozens of secret intelligence reports, other sensitive documents, once again, that all-important issue, on a gaming chat group. He's expected now to plead guilty on Monday, just a couple of days from now, on Monday, going into federal court, pleading guilty. We don't know exactly what that's going to be, but the government has filed a pleading in the federal district court there, indicating that this will be happening. Teixeira, of course, he's been in custody since he was arrested at his mother's home a long time ago. Prosecutors in this case finding no evidence of espionage, again, a lot of speculation about what the reason for his doing this, but concluded instead that the motivation that Jack Teixeira was doing this, again, in his role as this Air National Guardsman, he was just sharing secrets to his chat group. And it was a chat group called Discord. He was trying to impress people that he had met online with his insider information and particularly the details of the war in Ukraine. And that's the reason why this is so serious. Even though his motive may not have been to undermine our national security, but rather to boast, if you will, about the information that he has access to, the indictment against him making clear that he is working this intelligence unit. You cannot do this. You cannot disclose these kinds of things regardless of what your motivation is. Took the material off computers after conducting some unauthorized searches of databases, and again releases it to this social media platform, Discord. Presumably, the government's position will be to impress people he met online. Again, the motive, interesting, significant, but does not undermine the prosecution itself. Jack Teixeira, presumably on Monday, going to be pleading guilty to those federal charges, those criminal charges in federal court, alleging that he engaged in the mishandling, the improper handling, publicly disclosing some national defense secrets, and all of that going to be a part of our rule of law news coming up this coming Monday. In these last moments of our broadcast, we're going to go back to what I promised for a couple of broadcasts now and talk about some things overseas. From time to time, we recognize that the United States of America is not the only place on the face of the planet where we've got challenges, but also good things happening when it comes to the administration of justice. I'm going to take a look at some of those on both sides of that ledger in the remaining time here this morning. Let's talk first about our neighbor to the immediate south. We recognize as well, as we have talked a lot on this broadcast, about the importance of voting and elections and the impact that who you vote for, who you put in office, whether it's a legislative representative, whether it's somebody in an executive branch, those people, depending upon how judges are selected, all those kinds of things have an impact upon the rule of law, the administration of government, and our understanding about fairness and decency in our nation. And so let's look south. Let's look to the nation of Mexico. Campaigning for the chief executive position there starts just this past week, beginning anew, if you will, on Monday, the biggest election arguably in recent history in Mexico. Voters are going to choose the president of the nation, along with about 628 seats in Congress and arguably about tens of thousands of local positions. The Mexican nation, of course, about 130 million people, has often been marked by interesting, as our own country has been, leaders of that nation. And almost certainly now, it is poised in the coming times to elect its first woman president. That's going to be coming up fairly soon. Right after this break, we'll tell you about who that might be, about the important rule of law campaign now underway in Mexico, and then also talk about other areas, including Brazil and Pakistan, right after this break.
listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, the Fox Phillies home of Mino and the Mayor.
The Todd Almost Show.
I'm Trigvi Olsen. Steven from Green Bay, go ahead.
The city of Green Bay is one of the best places in Wisconsin to live. Plenty of people that are Wisconsin nice.
Totally agree. Green Bay is kind of swing territory between the two parties, but people in Green Bay work together. I mean, people aren't asking themselves, am I wearing a red hat or a blue hat? They're wearing green and gold hats.
The Todd Almost Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hey, son. How are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it. Navigating without a compass, eyes waiting, started to wonder. Metamorphosis, philosopher you thought you was.
When your kid can't find the language, help them find the lyrics. Listen to the Sound It Out album and get tips and tools to start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
Rule of Law this morning, going overseas in our last moments together on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking right now at Mexico and the likelihood, almost the certainty, that in 2025, our Mexican friends and colleagues to the south are going to elect the first woman president, the first female president in the history of that nation. How's that going to come about? The presidential election, again, just about 3 months away. One thing clear, the candidate for the governing party there appears to be running away with it. And who is she? Her name is Claudia Sheinbaum, S-H-E-I-N-B-A-U-M. She's a physicist, not surprisingly. She's a protege of the current president. She holds a commanding lead of about 30 percentage points in the polls over the opposition leader, who is a woman named Jacqueline Galvez. She's a tech entrepreneur and campaigning, again, officially started just yesterday, getting underway in a major way this coming week. And again, for the next several months, the country, again, going to the polls in 2025. So what do we know about Ms. Sheinbaum? She is described as by some people as still a great mystery of this election. We know she's a scientist. She has a different way of thinking, which is probably a very good thing for all sorts of reasons. And sooner or later, as a part of this campaign, a lot of her positions on significant things will be underscored and highlighted in the public domain there in Mexico. Sheinbaum is a member of a group called the Morena. That's the governing party. She's a former mayor of the city of Mexico City and has always allied herself with the present president, whose name is Andres Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO. People in Mexico describe him as AMLO. He's hugely popular there, and she is basically his deputy, if you will. And not surprising then that in a country where there's a term limit, and that is why AMLO is not running again in this coming election, Sheinbaum has, again, a dramatic lead, in part because of her alliance with the current president, but also indicating that she has her own views about what may happen down the road. Among other things, she parted company somewhat with the president over issues related to handling COVID. When she was mayor of Mexico City, her management of the pandemic differed dramatically from that of the federal government. She tried to follow science, which, again, is a good thing. And the current and then president downplayed the risks of that. Sounds familiar right here in the United States of America as well. She's also said that she'd focus on renewable energy in contrast to the present executive branch focus that prioritizes fossil fuels. All of that coming up in this coming campaign. There's an issue of security, of course. There is a clear focus on how one addresses issues related to public safety and security there in Mexico, true of our nation as well. Sheinbaum has vowed to improve the training of the police, increasing their salaries, investing in intelligence, measures that she put in place while she was the mayor of Mexico City. Now, she does have some opposition. As I said, Ms. Galvez, who's this tech entrepreneur, also campaigning for the same office, but far behind in the polls. Every indication, unless some things change dramatically, the two things will happen. One is
that Ms. Sheinbaum will be elected the next president of Mexico and making history in many ways as the first female president of that nation, beating us, if you will, to that important milestone in history. We almost did it in 2016 with the, among many groups, the presumed election of the former Secretary of State and former senator from the state of New York, former First Lady. Her name is Hillary Clinton, of course. She was not elected, but came close. And we've certainly had other candidates, other female candidates in our national history. Mexico almost certainly in 2025 going to vote in their first female president. And again, putting aside gender, someone who plainly is forward-looking, who in all these areas of security and of healthcare and education and fuels and climate, all those issues, is someone who is not only somewhat in the shadow still of the current president, but also is plainly going to make her own path as she presumably becomes the next president sometime in 2025. Why is that important? Why did we talk about it this morning? Well, because, as we know well in this country, the election of a president makes all the difference in the world. It is a rule of law issue. It is a justice issue. It is a government issue. And it animates dramatically the ways in which we think about what government does, the services it provides to us, this notion that the government at all levels, whether the president of Mexico, the president of the United States of America, you are in service to us. And we elect you as a part of our democratic process in this republic to ensure that we've got safety and security going forward, to ensure that our voice is heard. And that's what the elections there in Mexico, that is certainly what the elections coming up in this calendar year and beyond in our nation are all about. We've got Super Tuesday coming up right here next week in our nation. 16 states going to the polls, other polling happening, of course, here in the state of Wisconsin in April, in August. And then again, as you well know, in November, beyond that as well. A couple of other things happening out there. Likewise, just to mention them, we know that in the nation of Brazil, former President Jair Bolsonaro, according to allegations made public recently, while he was president, oversaw a broad conspiracy to hold on to power, regardless of the results of the 2022 election. Again, reverberations of what we have seen here in our own nation. He personally edited a proposal to arrest a Supreme Court justice, according to some accusations that were made public fairly recently. Bolsonaro recently, again, no longer in office, was interviewed recently, remained silent during the course of the investigative review of that matter. But there again, in Brazil, this major event having to do with the former president under investigation for having tried to remain in power and even to affect the judiciary there in the nation of Brazil. Quite dramatic. And then we have Pakistan as well, the party of an imprisoned former prime minister. His name is Imran Khan. Imran Khan, that party won the most seats in the parliamentary elections this week, even though Imran Khan is still in prison. It is plainly a strong rebuke there in Pakistan to the country's very powerful generals. And it basically has thrown the political system there in many ways into chaos. Military leaders had hoped that the election would put an end to the political turmoil there, and that the present opposition party, that is Pakistan's PTI, would not be in power. That's Mr. Khan's party in Pakistan these days. A lot of issues there as well related to the rule of law and what happens when people come forward and vote contrary to what the military would want, but what they want. And as Pakistan goes forward, even to this day, in determining its leadership, whether it continues to support Imran Khan or others in positions of leadership, all of that a part of the rule of law as we continue to look internally and also overseas. We'll continue these discussions in our future broadcasts. As always, inviting your participation here on the broadcast studios of Civic Media. Thank you so much for joining me and my producer, Sam, today. Join us again next week for more of the same kind of discussion. Have a good week, everybody.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates, weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. Oshkosh Air Support, 1100 AM and 98.3 FM WISS.
Hey, it's John Mino. Make sure to be with us Monday morning as Mino and the Mayor expands an extra hour, 6 till 9 on WISS and WGBW.
You know, I hope this is the best hour of your life. I'll tell you that. The Kripes Cast, folks.
Comedian Mary Mack.
He's noticed a very sizable increase on people off the lake coming onto our lake to fish it. You don't want everything to be popular and known about. That seems to be the way I also approach my comedy, Charlie. I think there's a theme.
Kripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to Oshkosh Air Support. WISS 1100 AM Berlin, W252DR Oshkosh, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The U.S. carried out its first airdrop a few minutes